This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
We had hoped to bring you a fresh show in the last week of February, which is known to be Black History Month. We had a couple of pretty good items that would have been perfect for that month, but they're still good items, but they're going to have to be aired at a different time, one of which will be today. In our second half today, we expect to speak with author Jefferson Morley about his second book titled Snowstorm in August, with the subheadline, The Struggle for American Freedom and Washington's Race Riot of 1835. Jeff Morley is a journalist and an editor who's worked in Washington, D.C. for over 30 years, 15 of which were spent as an editor and reporter at the Washington Post. He's also written about intelligence, military, and political subjects for Salon, Slate, Counterpunch, Just Security, and The Intercept, among others. We have plugged his excellent website, JFK Facts, on this program on many occasions, and would suggest that you check out that website if you have not yet done so. I was completely unaware of the fact that there was a race riot in our nation's capital in 1835. And the curious thing for me about this is that when Jeff wrote this book back in 2013, it had been a long time since there'd been any riots in the nation's capital. But in the meantime, there's been a certain update in that subject matter. Anyway, please stay tuned for Jeff Morley in our second segment. The other item we had for Black History Month was about the explosion that took place at Port Chicago here in California in 1943, wherein hundreds of black sailors were injured and later court-martialed when they refused to turn to work. It's a hell of a story. They are represented legally by Thurgood Marshall, who later became a Supreme Court justice. There's a story there, but we won't get to that one today. Something we do hope to speak with you about very soon is the fact that a terrible thing is taking place in Sacramento. The United States Army Corps of Engineers are tearing up the levees of the American River. They're removing hundreds of trees, supposedly for flood control. And personally, we here at Radio Parallax thinks the whole thing smells to high heaven. We urge anyone listening to this program who lives in or around Sacramento to go take a look at what they've done so far and then do a little research. We can start you off with an article by Rosalio Ahumada from the February 21st Sacramento Bee, which is quite an excellent summary. And we strongly urge you to Google American River Trees to read what a group that has risen up in opposition to this travesty has to say about what the Army Corps of Engineers wants to do. We do hope to bring you some representatives of American River Trees in the week or weeks to come. The Bee article quotes a William Avery, a Sacramento State biology professor emeritus and member of the American River Trees group, who notes that project officials should have done more appropriate analysis on environmental impacts, and there should have been more public involvement in a design process to create a less destructive approach. As it stands right now, the Army Corps is going to go in and rip out, in some cases, heritage trees that have been there for centuries, since before the gold rush. And in some cases, not because they think that the trees will cause leakage in the levee. No, it's because to get the riprap that they want to put along the sides of the bank embankments, they have to knock trees out of the way to drive their big vehicles in. Now, I feel pretty passionate about this because yours truly, when he was in high school, got to witness some flood control, quote-unquote, measures done in the Bay Area in Alameda County, on Alameda Creek, in fact, which runs through Niles Canyon and then out to the bay. When I was a boy, there used to be all sorts of trees and bushes and wildlife and birds along the banks of the creek. I know that before me, my dad and friends of his talked about how they could get salmon and steelhead upriver in the creek. But after the Army Corps of Engineers came in, and a few others as well, the riprap along the sides turned the entire lower stretch of the creek into a kind of a moonscape. 50 years later, it still looks pretty bad. There is a bikeway along Alameda Creek, which in some alternate universe scenario parallels the American River Parkway, except for the fact that it's barren and unbelievably ugly. And I sure don't want to see the Parkway look like that. I lived in Sacramento for several decades, and one of the major reasons, if not maybe the single greatest reason I lived in that town, was because of the recreation offered to residents and bicyclists along that stretch of the American River. Anyway, that's all we're going to say today, except for the fact that I can't resist noting that the Army Corps put out a video showing why they need to have this flood control. And of course, they can't resist mentioning the fact that Sacramento is really vulnerable to flooding. Of course, they leave out the fact that the reason that Sacramento is so vulnerable to flooding is because they built out in the Natomas Basin. They built homes and schools and stores in areas that will be 20 feet underwater should that portion of the levee give way. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that this is not really about flood control at all. That's my personal opinion. I think it's more likely about the fact that there's a lot of money involved in putting riprap along the banks of a river. At any rate, we will, I promise, return to this subject. Now, as it so happens, the timing of Mr. Millen and I sitting here with a microphone that's live coincides within a few hours of an epic Supreme Court decision, a unanimous Supreme Court decision that apparently is based upon the principle that the Constitution is not what you read it to be, which I think is in parallel fashion to these are not the droids you're looking for. Now, one of our regular contributors to this program, Howard McKinney, wrote us a while back to say that, well, you know what, seeing what's going on with the Supreme Court, isn't it clear by now that the fix is in? Meaning that the Supreme Court, with its three Trump appointees, is going to grease the skids for a return to the presidency by DJ Trump. Now, I'm not a legal scholar, and we do hope to bring Stephen Harper, who is on the program soon, to talk about some of these developments. But I do know that the wording in the Constitution says that you can't hold federal office if you've led an insurrection against the United States. Now, what is it about January 6th and Trump's role in it that is questionable about meeting that criteria? Now, given the fact that elections in this country are a state-run affair, you'd think that if someone in Colorado or Illinois or Maine, because three states tried to do this, decided that, well, you know, he's really not eligible for high office because of what it says in the Constitution, so we're not going to let you put him on the ballot. Well, the Supreme Court decided, well, that was just nonsense. And I guess the reasoning at this point of these nine robed semi-criminals is that Congress would have to act after an election to bar someone from actually holding the office that he just won. And of course, we all know what the odds of that happening are. In fact, Mr. McMillan, we probably should take a minute and pull a quote off of CNN from Michael Luttig, a well-known conservative judge who has offered up some very salty opinions about what's been going on. Go to Jake Tapper and Judge Michael Luttig.
You predicted that the Supreme Court would affirm Colorado's decision to remove Trump from the ballot, calling Colorado's decision unassailable in every single respect under the Constitution, unquote. I guess the justices didn't see it your way. What's your reaction?
Today's ruling, Jake, was both astonishing and unprecedented, not for its decision of the exceedingly narrow question presented by the case, though that issue was important, but rather for its decision to reach and decide a myriad of the other constitutional issues surrounding disqualification under 14th Amendment. In reaching and deciding those questions unnecessarily, the court, the majority, as the concurrences said, effectively decided former President will never be disqualified from holding the presidency in 2024, or ever, for that matter. But even more importantly, as the concurrence said, effectively the court today decided that no person in the future will ever be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, regardless whether he or she has engaged in an insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution of the United States.
Now, when we last spoke to you a couple of weeks back, there'd been an accident apparently in a prison in above the Arctic Circle in Russia, and doggone it, leading dissident, anti-Putin politician Alex Navalny died mysteriously. Our speculation that perhaps he slipped on a banana peel has now apparently been eliminated among the possibilities. The Russian government has substituted the diagnosis of sudden death syndrome. And it is remarkable how often sudden death syndrome seems to strike political opponents of Vladimir Putin. And we might want to mention a few to add to the death of Alex Navalny at age 47. There was Mikhail Lesin, who back in November of 2015 died at age 57. He was found dead in a Washington, D.C. hotel room. The official cause of death was ruled as accidental blunt force injuries. Boy, it sounds like the D.C. police really did their homework on that one. And, of course, there was Boris Nemtsov, who died at age 55, also back in 2015. He was shot dead on a bridge near the Kremlin. At that point in time, he was the leading political opponent to Vladimir Putin. He advocated for democracy, human rights, and transparency. Well, at least up till when he was shot. And, of course, there's Boris Berezovsky, who died at age 67 back in 2013. He was found dead in his home in Berkshire, England. The official cause of death was ruled as suicide. But let's just say that suspicions remain due to his high-profile opposition activities. There's also Sergei Magnitsky, died at age 37 back in 2009. He was a lawyer and auditor who exposed massive tax fraud involving Russian officials. He died in custody following severe beatings and medical neglect. His death did lead to the passing of the Magnitsky Act in the U.S., which sanctions Russian officials involved in human rights abuses and corruption. Let's see. There's also Stanislav Markelov, died at age 34 back in 2009. And doggone it, he was assassinated in Moscow by a gunman who also killed journalist Anastasia Babarova. I'm sure that was a coincidence. And how about Natalia Estimarova, died at age 50 in 2009. She's a human rights activist and journalist who was covering, I guess, events in Chechnya. She was abducted and found dead later the same day. And there's Anna Politkovskaya, who died at age 48 back in 2006. She was an investigative journalist found shot dead in her apartment building in Moscow. Anyway, it seems to be a proven fact at this point that if you're a political foe of Vladimir Putin, who has now been the longest-serving leader of Russia since Joseph Stalin, and they're about to hold a sham election in the weeks to come where he's, well, let's just say we predict he will be reelected. Oh, by the way, we didn't even mention Litvinenko, killed by polonium-210, something that, you know, the average poisoner does not have access to. And also Sergei Skripal, who got poisoned by Novichok when he was living in the UK along with his daughter. And it may be worth mentioning that about a week ago, the bullet-riddled body of a Russian pilot who had defected to Ukraine last year was found in a parking lot in Spain. He'd been shot half a dozen times and run over by a car. The pilot, Maxim Kuzminov, had flown his Russian Mi-8 Army helicopter across the front lines to Kharkiv last August, having arranged his defection ahead of time. He handed over secret technical equipment to Ukrainian military intelligence and apologized publicly for the killing, the tears, and the blood caused by Russian invasion. By the way, in the wake of the passing of Alex Navalny, President Joe Biden has met with his widow and promised that there will be repercussions and sanctions put on Russia on account of what happened to her husband. Donald Trump weighed in on the matter as well, in the wake of noting in early February that he would encourage Russia to invade NATO if they weren't paying their bills and do whatever the hell they want with countries that, in his mind, weren't paying their bills. Well, Trump as yet has not publicly condemned Alex Navalny's shocking death, but the former president did offer an analogy in comparing himself to Navalny in a post in February. His social media site, Truth Social, had a headline, Biden:Trump:Putin:Navalny. Noted the Washington Post, Trump, who's under multiple criminal investigations, has long claimed without evidence that the U.S. justice system has been weaponized against him. In other conspiratorial news, we note that the MAGA people were apparently terrified last month about the possibility that the Taylor Swift / Travis Kelce romance would somehow benefit Biden to the detriment of Donald Trump. Yes, apparently Fox News, among others, was promoting the idea that the very public romance between the pop superstar and the Kansas City Chiefs tight end is a Pentagon psyop involving a sprawling cabal of deep state globalists encompassing the White House, George Soros, and the National Football League, which supposedly engineered the Chiefs' Super Bowl run to lend more oomph to the power couple's presumed 2022 2024 endorsement of President Biden. Though I do want to note on the side that on this program we voiced the possibility that there's something funny about the NFL, particularly in playoff games. And doggone, I must report some bad blood between myself and someone who's contributed to the show in the past and has been a longtime friend who did invite me to his Super Bowl party and was a little bit miffed when I declined. And I must confess, I had a sneaking suspicion that as that game evolved, the San Francisco 49ers would somehow at the last minute get aced out by the heroics of Patrick Mahomes. I'm not saying that I think they fixed the game, but I just have a suspicion that it might have happened. I mean, the number of these scripted-type Hollywood endings that have taken place in NFL playoff games in recent years is just, it's got to be a little suspicious. And of course, in this Super Bowl, a tie game goes into overtime, and wouldn't you know it, as the clock runs out at the end of overtime, the Chiefs managed to score a touchdown and win the game. My own personal possible conspiracy theory in all of this involves corporate money and the NFL and how to maximize their profits and not the deep state and George Soros. Anyway, I'm pretty sure at my friend's Super Bowl party that as the Super Bowl contest came to its conclusion, it was not, I'm sure, a room full of joy. And no, I'm not sorry I missed it. By the way, if you wanted to get into that Super Bowl, it's hard to imagine, but apparently the minimum, the least expensive ticket you could have purchased to witness the matchup between the Chiefs and the Niners was $8,200. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread this. That was a week before the game. When it got right up to the time of the kickoff, the price was up to $9,850. I'm not sure even George Soros would have kicked in for that. And in a matter that's much more serious and a lot less frivolous than what I've just been talking about, I need to, I think, turn the clock back to how it is political opposition can be bad for your health. And it turns out that that's not just the case in Russia. It's also true right here in the U.S. of A. And to that end, we recommend most highly to you, dear listener, that you check out the Netflix documentary, which was produced by the makers of the cult expose Wild Wild Country. The current documentary is entitled American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders, and surrounds the mystery of the death of reporter Danny Casolaro back in 1991. His death was ruled a suicide at the time, but people close to him suspected he'd been murdered for trying to write a book about an international cabal headed by at least 8 former government officials, which he dubbed the Octopus. What was remarkable to me in watching the documentary was how often some of these subplots that are in this documentary have been talked about on this program over the past couple of decades. Things like the October surprise, the suspicion back in 1980 that Bill Casey and vice presidential candidate George Herbert Walker Bush arranged for the Iranian government to hold on to the hostages, which had been taken when the Tehran embassy was overrun, to keep them, just keep the hostages till after Reagan was inaugurated, because there was fear that if Jimmy Carter sprung the hostages, there would be a great feeling of goodwill toward the president, and he might get reelected. We spoke briefly with Barbara Honegger many years ago about her book, October Surprise. We've tried to reach out to Barbara on a couple of occasions since then to have her return to the show, but we have not been able to make that happen, but it might. Anyway, I know a couple people will have some insights into the story of Danny Casolaro and the Octopus murders. And we do hope to bring them on the program in the not-too-distant future. And that means, dear listener, that in the meantime, your homework, should you desire it, would be to check out the documentary so it will mean more when we talk to these people about what went down. Anyway, Mr. Mueller, at this point, I think we need to lighten things up a little.
You mean open the curtains?
No, I think we should just change topics a little bit to something a little lighter. We can't really go wrong, I think, with the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Thank you.
Gruen of the Week magazine, it was a good week a few weeks back for moving the needle after Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel was announced as a backer of the Enhanced Games. This is an upstart rival to the Olympics in which athletes will be encouraged to use performance-enhancing drugs out in the open and, quote, honestly, unquote. That's probably really good news for Lance Armstrong.
And Radio Parallax guest Floyd Landis.
Floyd Landis assured us on the program that he did not use performance-enhancing drugs before he later admitted that, well, no, actually he had. And it was also a good week more recently for the up-and-coming sport of cornhole. Yay! With the news that two Colorado high school students have won university scholarships for their prowess at cornhole. Jason Remnick and Gavin Harmon are headed for Division I Winthrop University, where cornhole coach Dusty Thompson says he hopes to recruit a full squad of 10 players. Once kids see these guys are here, he said, they're going to know this is where they want to be. Let's switch over to what it was a bad week for. A couple weeks back, it was a bad week for draining the swamp after Donald Trump, who holds up to $5 million in Anheuser-Busch stock, asked conservatives to give Bud Light a second chance and abandon their boycott of the firm over its brief sponsorship deal with a transgender influencer. It was also a bad week for family values recently when the Los Angeles Times revealed that the GOP frontrunner in the race for the California U.S. Senate seat, that of former L.A. Dodger star Steve Garvey, is not the, quote, devoted family man, unquote, that he claims to be. Turns out two of his adult children were born out of wedlock, and they told the paper that Garvey rebuffed their repeated attempts to communicate and only met them in family court. And his oldest child from his first marriage, Cresha Garvey, said Garvey stopped talking to her 15 years ago and has not tried to build a relationship with her three kids. When questioned by the Times about his children's remarks, Garvey did not respond, but did say in a statement that his 35-year marriage to his current wife, Candace, quote, demonstrates my growth and commitment to family values, unquote. And as far as things that it was an ugly week for, we have, first of all, from several weeks back, the fact that it was an ugly week for counter-espionage, with the news that a pigeon held for 8 months on suspicion of being a Chinese spy was set free by Indian authorities. Apparently, the officials in India determined that the bird, which had a pair of ankle rings bearing Chinese writing, was in fact a lost Taiwanese racing pigeon. And no, Radio Parallax has no information on what it is the Indian officials found so suspicious about the Chinese spy pigeon. We're pretty sure the pigeon was just grateful it didn't wind up as crispy pigeon on the menu. And it was an ugly week, we'd have to say, for peer review this last week after the journal Frontiers in Cell Development and Biology apologized for publishing a nonsensical study that included an AI-generated diagram of a rat with a penis more than twice the length of its body. The study, Frontier said, lacked scientific rigor. Well, we think it lacked more than that. And in a parallel item, as reported by The Economist magazine about cheating in Chinese-published scientific papers, We have to note with some glee that researchers probing some of these Chinese papers found one, a paper on prostate cancer, which claimed that more than half of the patients studied were women. Now, in case you're not familiar with basic biology, only men have prostate glands. All right, a few weeks back, we dug out some old Harper's Indexes and read some of the stats from that magazine. And it just so happens that while traveling about in California recently, I stumbled on a bookstore that actually had magazines on the rack and got myself a fresh issue of Harper's, allowing me to quote from more recent statistics, such as percentage increase since 2018 in the portion of American 15-year-olds who are not proficient in math comes in at 25%. I'm particularly tickled by the portion of American men who say they could safely land a plane in an emergency if someone talked them through it. Well, that's one American male out of two. And as someone who holds a private pilot's license, I'm here to tell you that the odds of making that work are less than 50-50. We have here the percentage of Gen Z Americans who suffer from quote, menu anxiety, unquote, coming in at 86%. And no, we don't know enough about menu anxiety. But we can note that the percentage of Gen Z Americans who ask other people to order for them at restaurants because of it comes in at 34%. And the percentage of Gen Z Americans who use self-checkout aisles because of social anxiety comes in at 38%. How about this one? Percentage of professors at U.S. universities who report feeling the need to self-censor when talking about the war in Gaza, 76%. Of graduate students, it comes in at 96%. Harper's Index cites the minimum estimated annual revenue U.S. news publishers miss out on as a result of Facebook's use of their content at $1.9 billion. That's a minimum. And the estimated annual revenue U.S. publishers miss out as a result of Google's use of their material is at least $10 billion. And finally, we have a percentage by which private equity-owned hospitals have fewer staff members than those under other forms of ownership, 13%, correlating to the percentage increase in the frequency of falls by patients in hospitals after they're acquired by private equity firms, 27%. We talked briefly about private equity firms some time back when Mitt Romney was making a run at the presidency. We need to get a guest we've had on in the distant past to talk about things like hedge funds, which in my friend's estimation were just a way for really rich people to move money around without constraint. But no, you see that term hedge fund or hedge fund owner thrown around all the time, and that's something we need to take a look at. Mr. Mullen points out that Vivek Ramaswamy, who made a futile attempt to become the Republican nominee for president, is apparently himself a former hedge fund director. Do you suppose Vivek will talk to us?
Probably not.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Although he's probably got a lot more time on his hands now than he did a couple of months ago.
Well, idle hands are the devil's tools. And I guess our final item from the Harper's Index would be number of radio programs that need to take a break in the next minute or so. That would be one and would be Radio Parallax. So let's do that. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned for Jefferson Morley. He's always interesting. I'm Douglas Everett.